Thanks, Philip, and thanks, Dougal, as well, for praying for us as we spend time in God's Word a little earlier. Welcome as well, if you've joined us this week for the first time. We're in the middle of a series in 2 Samuel, and we're at a more confronting passage today. But let's get stuck into it. Over the last few weeks, as I've been walking around, I've noticed that the bindies are out of control. Now, I'm hardly a great gardener, and while I knew bindi season was on the way, I've still been shocked just by the sheer proliferation of bindies around the place, both the number of bindies as well as their location. In our place, just over there, the backyard didn't get any last year. The courtyard had some, but I thought I did a pretty thorough job of removing them last year. But the conditions over the last couple of months have revealed the plethora of seeds that were hidden in the soil. This is not an extended plug for joining the church grounds care team, though if you want to do that, I'm sure Hilton would love to hear from you later. But I think the explosion of bindies that we're seeing around the place, it gives something of a picture of what sin can be like, hidden in our hearts until the right conditions causes it to bloom. This morning we are wrestling with the story of David committing adultery, lying about it, and instituting a conspiracy that ends in the murder and deaths of multiple innocent men. But before we dig in, it's important that we remember and we keep in mind just how impressive David has been up to this point. You know, without rehashing everything, I mean, since we met him back in 1 Samuel, we've seen David accomplish great things. He's defeated Goliath. We've seen him protect God's people on numerous occasions, even when his life was under threat and he was being pursued by Saul for several years on the run. But more than just accomplishing great things, there are plenty of people who accomplish great things but are terrible people. We have also seen the greatness of David's character, his refusal to take Saul's life and the throne, despite Saul hunting David, trying to take his life and the opportunity to do it being right in front of him. David refused to take Saul's life, but continued to seek the good of both Saul and the nation. In our series in 2 Samuel, we've seen David grieve Saul's death and teach others to do the same thing. We've seen him make peace with men like Abner, who had incited civil war against David. And actually, in between last week's passage from 2 Samuel 7 and this week's passage, if you read those chapters, you'd see David seeking out a surviving member of Saul's house in order to show kindness and blessing to them. And even the conflict that's the backdrop for today's passage comes about because of David's kindness. The Ammonites were one of Israel's neighbouring kingdoms. The old king of the Ammonites, he had been hostile towards Israel and he had died. David attempted to show kindness to the new king, but his kindness was met with hostility. Commencing the context of today's passage. So we can't minimise the impressiveness of David, not just because of his achievements, but because of his character, which makes today's story even more confronting. But as disturbing it is, it's a story that God has given us for a reason, and so it's important that we think carefully about what he has to say to us. So as we look at this passage this morning, we've got three main points. There's a lot of things we can reflect on as we go through the passage. Three main points that are there on your outline if you like to take notes to help stay a bit focused. Flee from sexual immorality, beware the deceitful heart, and grieve the reality of sin. There are three points that we're looking at. So point one, flee from sexual immorality, verses 1 to 5. As our story begins, the narrator sets us up as being the time that the kings march to war, but David's staying in Jerusalem. Some people, looking to the story ahead, make a big deal about this being David's first folly, not being where he was meant to be. It does raise the question of should David have been out with the army. There's legitimacy to that, some wisdom to think about where we are and if we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I'm not sure that's the main point of what's going on. I think given how the events of today's passage consciously shift the focus from the battle at the end of chapter 10 and interrupts this story, which picks up again halfway through the next chapter, I think the main thing that the narrator is doing is actually causing us to wonder, why are we focused on Jerusalem? Because there's this battle happening there in the east at Rabbah, in the capital of Ammon. But for some reason, we're being taken back to Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Surely the interesting stories are happening at Rabbah, the city under siege. Why are we back in Jerusalem, where David is safe from harm? Verse 2, one evening David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace, and from the roof he saw a woman washing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messages to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. And David walking on the roof of his palace and seeing a woman bathing, a chance sighting, accidents happen. From what we know of David so far, you know, this could just be another occasion where we get to see David's impressive character on display and how he handles this situation. I mean, we could easily imagine how he could have responded. He could have averted his gaze. He could have gone and found something else to do. He could have ordered some trees planted to provide a screen for the future. But instead, he leers. He takes in the fact that this woman was very beautiful. He could have stopped there. Not great, but, you know, we have moments of weakness. But unfortunately, David goes further. He makes inquiries and learns that she was married to Uriah the Hittite, one of David's elite soldiers. How David should respond now is even clearer. I mean, of the Ten Commandments, commandment number 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Commandment number 7, you shall not commit adultery. Kind of black and white, but instead, verse 4, David sent messages to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. I mean, when you think about it, the build-up to the moment is actually quite a lot. There's quite a lot of anticipation in David, you know, seeing her, wondering about her, looking at her, sending a messenger to inquire about her, sending a messenger to get her. There's a lot of anticipation there. But the actual event kind of seems quite transactional and unsatisfying. David lies with her and she returns to her house, which is so often the way with sin. It promises much but delivers so little. Before we move on with the story, it is worth reflecting on the fact that sex is a good gift from God. In the God-given context of marriage, it honours God, but it's all too easily twisted. The Bible's sexual ethic is for our good, and it protects true sexual freedom, and David here is an example of why Christians are exhorted to flee from all sexual immorality. If we are wise, as we listen to this story, we will learn from David's folly and take whatever steps are needed for us to flee sexual immorality. And so it's worth asking, are there steps you need to take today? Is there something you need to do to flee sexual immorality today? I mean, turning back to the story, I kind of want to know more, not in a lurid sense, but, you know, details like, why did David do this? What led to this situation? Or what was Bathsheba's experience? We haven't heard anything from her point of view. Things that would give us more insight into what happened and why, but as important as those questions might be in their own context, the story has been told in a particular way to keep our attention squarely on David and his actions. There are a couple of points in today's passage where I actually think a more literal translation helps to draw out some significant details for us in the story. The NIV that we're reading from, it's an excellent translation. And every now and then, making good English translations, though, might miss some of the echoes that a more wooden translation might notice. So when the passage says David sent messages to get her and she came to him, a more literal translation would be David sent messages and took her. You might remember back in 1 Samuel 8, when the people demanded a king, Samuel warned them what the king would be like. Samuel said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons. He will take your daughters. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves. He will take, he will take, he will take." David was the king who God chose, and up until now he has refused to be a king who takes. He refused to take Saul's life. He refused to take the throne himself. But now, here, he takes. For all that was impressive about him, David was just as capable as behaving like the kings of the nations. And the reason is that he shares the same nature as the kings of the nations. This story about David is actually told in a way that echoes another story. Let me just pull out some of the key parallels. David saw from the roof a woman bathing, and she was very beautiful. David sent messages and took her and lay with her. Genesis chapter 3, verse 6. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. The narrator has told this story in a way to show us that David, even though he was chosen by God, he still shared the same problem that all of humanity has shared since the fall in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3. David has a sinful heart. But that's not the end of the story. First, we learn that Bathsheba had been cleansing herself after her period. Just a bit of background, ancient Israel had a series of religious laws that were designed to help God's people learn that God is holy, which just means distinctive or set apart, and he calls his people to be holy. And there were lots of different situations that God's people would regularly find themselves in that would require them to cleanse themselves, and one of those was a woman's period. So Bathsheba, cleansing herself after her period, firstly, I think it underlines that Bathsheba was following the law, not in trying to entice David, like some people might try and suggest. But secondly, it establishes that she was not pregnant before David took her. There is no question about who is the father of her child. We're up to point two, beware the deceitful heart, verses 6 to 13. David's actions in taking Bathsheba had consequences that couldn't be ignored, and the question is, how will David handle them? Verse 6, David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. What would David do? Again, we've seen David's character up until this point. In the 1 and 2 Samuel narratives, we kind of expect that he is someone who will do the right thing. He will seek shalom, relational peace and wholeness with Uriah. Surely that's what he's going to do. Well, in verse 7, we see David ask how Joab is doing, how the troops are doing, and how the war was going. To translate it literally, David asks about their shalom, their peace, their wholeness. Everyone except Uriah. And then having delivered the report, we learn of David's real reason for summoning Uriah. Go down to your house and wash your feet. Go home, put your feet up. Enjoy some shore leave. Some scholars even think that there's something of a euphemism in David's suggestion to wash your feet. Maybe a modern equivalent might be go and enjoy Netflix and chill, which is only enhanced by the king sending a gift after him. In my head, it's a rather unsubtle gift basket of roses, chocolates, and a Barry White CD. But you get the hint. Unfortunately, the ploy doesn't work. Uriah sleeps at the entrance of the palace with his master's servants and does not go down to his house. And as the king questions Uriah the next morning, Uriah's righteous words and actions really only highlight David's sinful words and actions. The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my lord's men are camped in open country. How could I go into my house and eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. So David orders Uriah to stay another night, and again Given what we've seen of David across 1 and 2 Samuel so far, it's not unfair to think surely now Uriah's speech and actions might be a wake-up call for David. Surely he's going to come to his senses. But it's not the case. This time David makes Uriah drunk, presumably hoping that some reduced inhibitions might end in Uriah enjoying some of the comforts of home. But again, it fails. Drunk Uriah is more righteous than sober David. I mean, how do we make sense of this different side of David that we're seeing? We've already seen David shares the same sinful heart we all do, and that includes the fact that sin and the sinful heart are deceptive. Several hundred years later, the prophet Jeremiah put it this way: "The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it?" The human heart is capable of great deception, of failing to recognize our own sinfulness, of drowning out the warnings of others that we don't want to hear. But if we're willing to recognize the deceptiveness of our hearts, we will be well placed to hear the warning from our second reading in Hebrews chapter 3. We heard it say, "See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage each other daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness." Friends, we are well served by having and listening to fellow Christians who we will listen to when they point out that our hearts might be deceiving us or are deceiving us. If Christians who we know to be faithful and wise and gentle and care about us are calling out our sin, whether they're doing it intentionally or not, and they're pointing us back to Jesus, it would be foolish, utterly foolish, to ignore them as David does, because ignoring sin is a road to disaster, which is sadly what we see in the final part of the chapter. A final point: grieve the reality of sin, verses 14 to 27. David's plans to resolve the issue of Bathsheba's pregnancy have failed because of Uriah's righteousness, and so David gets desperate. He initiates a conspiracy with Joab, the commander of the army, to have Uriah killed. We've met Joab before. He was David's cousin and the commander of the army, and he has a record of being someone who acts in what he thinks is the best interests of David's kingdom, even if David has said otherwise. And so perhaps recognizing that David's plan to put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest and then withdraw from him so that he's struck down and die might be a somewhat indiscreet way of disposing of Uriah, Joab adapts the plan. As the story continues and we piece together what happens, we learn that Joab has orchestrated an intentionally reckless, some might say foolish, attack against the city of Rabbah, creating the situation that led to Ammonite archers on the wall killing Uriah and several men. It cost more innocent lives, but it made Uriah's death seem like it was the result of Joab's recklessness rather than the king's conspiracy. There's so much in this story to make us feel ill, but the lowest point, I think, comes in verse 25. David told the messenger, "Say this to Joab, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. Press the attack against the city and destroy this. Say this to encourage Joab." Do you see how far we've come? A lustful glance developed into adultery, which seeded lies and deception and grew into the murder of several innocent men, including the righteous Uriah. And David encourages Joab by saying, "Don't let this upset you," or to translate it more literally, "Do not let this thing be evil in your eyes." We heard the echoes of Genesis 3 earlier when David saw Bathsheba, saw that she was beautiful and took her, much like Adam and Eve did with the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, deciding for ourselves what is good and what is evil, which is exactly what David has done. He has usurped God's authority. "Do not let this thing be evil in your eyes, Joab. Your king doesn't think it was bad, so neither should you." Except David is not the ultimate authority. David's title might be king, but he's a servant of the Lord, and the final words of our story are both encouraging in the sense that God has seen, but also ominous, because God has seen. The thing David had done displeased the Lord, or more literally, the thing that David had done was evil in the eyes of the Lord. But more on that next week. And how do you feel? How do you feel after reading 2 Samuel 11? Is it shocked? Angry? Depressed? Disgusted? I think I feel a mixture of all of them. And so the question is, why is this story here? What do we do with it? I mean, on the one hand, you could try and defend David here. Some people have gone down that road, maybe suggesting that Bathsheba enticed him, and ultimately it was messy, but it was for the good of the kingdom. Although there's no evidence to suggest that Bathsheba enticed him, and in fact, I think the evidence points the other way, and that whitewashes over the evil that we've clearly seen David do. So I don't think that's really an option. Or, we could cancel David. We could write him off as yet another example of a powerful man exploiting women and men just to get what he wants. That acknowledges some of the reality of the story, but it doesn't do justice to all the good that we've seen of him previously. The reality is that people are complex. There can be much that is good about an individual, both in what they achieve and even in their character, and yet they still have a sinful heart. Christian scholars and theologians sometimes talk about total depravity. The idea that sin has infected everything and everyone. It's not that everyone is as bad as they could be, but that no one and nothing is free of its grasp. And if even someone like King David, outstanding in his faith in God in all sorts of trials, displaying graciousness and mercy to enemies, someone who was chosen by God to rule his people. If David can fall in such a spectacularly tragic way, then it would be utterly foolish to think that I am cut from different cloth and it could never happen to me. Because the reality is that you and I and the people that we love and admire are no different. It doesn't eliminate the good things that we've done or positive aspects about our character, but it means we should recognise the pervasive presence of sin in our lives and that all it would take are the right conditions for you and I to behave just like David does here. So I think this passage calls us to grieve the pervasiveness of sin in ourselves, in those we love and admire, and those who we are different to. It is also just worth acknowledging that the pervasiveness of sin, it actually does give us a solid foundation for interacting with people, not who think similarly to us, but also from those who think differently to us, and we might actually be quite opposed to. When so many want to demonise those who think differently, and identify those others as being the problem, the pervasiveness of sin actually says the problem is never just out there, it's in here too. The German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, "There is nothing that we despise in the other man that is entirely absent from ourselves." And when we realise that he wrote that from inside a Nazi prison, we can really recognise that he wrestled with the reality of what that meant. The pervasiveness of sin exhorts us to have humility, recognising that the problems are not just out there, but in here as well. And so perhaps most significantly, it should remind me that without God, there is no hope that lasts. We are sinners in need of God's mercy. We are people who need to keep seeking God's mercy since we are prone to wander from God's ways. And we have no hope in what we can bring to the table of ourselves. Neither can God's cause in the world or in our lives be advanced apart from him, because we are utterly sinful. But thanks be to God, these things do not depend on us and on our sinful natures, Because as Paul writes in his letter to the Romans, God demonstrates his love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you love us enough to include stories like David and Bathsheba in your word, to help us recognize the reality of sin in our